Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Today we're in lesson 187. And at the end of last lesson, we're discussing the issue of the name of God. You know, what does it really mean when people ask about the name of God? Be it the children of Israel, or in this case, Jacob, in Genesis 32. And then we give some examples showing that when people ask about the name of God, it's not the name in the sense that you ask for somebody's name in order to know how to address him, but they're asking for something far deeper than that. They want to know that person, you know, his glory, his powers, his abilities, what is it that he can do? Because you live in an age where people were idol worshippers and every god had his own specific function. And so the God of Israel, obviously it was something totally different, and when people had a very close encounter with him, when they asked him about his name, it's not in the classical sense of the, you know, that we ask, you know, what is your name? But they're asking, in essence, about his own glory, his own intimacy. They want him to reveal himself to them in a far deeper way. And so this is what Jacob is asking here when he's wrestling with the angel, that he knows very well he's God, and he knows that he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and he knows that his name is El Shaddai, he knows that his name is Jehovah, he knows that his name is Elohim. So obviously he's not asking for his name in that sense, but for an intimate revelation of what he is, and also a display of his glory. And therefore, this man that is wrestling with him, that is God, and also angel, as he's referred to by in different places, when Jacob asked him, tell me, I pray you, what is your name? He replies, why is it that you want to know my name? Why do you ask after my name? Now, he's not, in essence, he's not replying to his question. And what he really means by that, only God knows. But obviously, at this point, he's not revealing himself to him. And as he said later on to Moses, I did not reveal myself to them in this sense. It's not that they didn't know my name, or this is what he's talking about. I did not show my glory to them, and they did not know me as the one that delivers, because the deliverance was for their children out of captivity, and they did not, in other words, they did not experience me in the way that you do now. And the glory, you know, that he was showing to Moses, and all the signs and wonders and miracles. We haven't heard about any of those things being performed by any of the fathers. So that's what he's talking about, not the name per se. And so he blessed him there. You know, he requested a blessing, and he gave him a blessing. And only God can give a blessing. Angels don't give blessings. And verse 31, we continue, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. Peni, or Pne, means face off, from Panim. Panim means face, that's in the plural. Some people have, for example, the question of Elohim, why is it in the plural? You see? Well, when you study Hebrew, you realize that there are certain things like Shamayim, the sky, is in the plural. And yet it is sky. It's not skies, but sky. And therefore, the word, you know, plural, Elohim, or Panim, which means face, and Shamayim, which is in the plural, but just means sky, that you find in Hebrew. And so it's not too difficult to understand. But, you know, when you don't know Hebrew, you see Elohim, and you wonder, why Elohim? Why plural? Then you say, well, there is more than one. Well, if there is more than one, you know, why use the plural for one person, you know, and Elohim said, you see? And that's where people get confused. They don't have enough background to understand the language, because Elohim, just because it is in the plural, does mean that it means more than one. It can be, it doesn't have to be, and therefore, it's not grammatically incorrect to say something in the plural, like Elohim, and then said, you know, the verb said in the singular. It's not a problem there. And so here again, we have Pniel, which means the face of God, and Pni comes from Panim, as I said, and that's in the plural, and yet it speaks only about one face. We don't have two faces, or three or four. So it's not an indication for plurality. Generally, it would be, you see. That's what the case is. Generally, the im signifies plural. But there are certain words in Hebrew that are not plural. Just, there is, in other words, it's not just like a nose, you know, just one little single item in the face, but the face contains the eyes and contains the nose and contains the mouth, and so it has a pluralistic concept there, and therefore it is in the plural, though it is one face. And the sky also contains, you know, the stars and the moon and so forth, the universe. In it, it is sky, just one sky. It's not this, you know, two, three, four skies. And so sometimes it's good to know the language so you understand what you're reading, and therefore you don't have to invent any doctrines or have misunderstandings. So it is, he called it Pni'el, he called the place. Pni means the face of, and El means God or deity. For I've seen God, I've seen El, that is, or I've seen Elohim, he said, face to face. So he appeared to him face to face, just like he appeared to Moses many times as a person. That's why Moses could see him. But Moses wanted to see beyond that. He wanted to see his glory, his majesty. You see, abilities and capacities that you can see when you see his fullness. And you don't just, you know, when you see a person, just like with Jesus Christ, you know, you look at him, well, he's a man, you know, just like any other man. But the disciples obviously desired to see a taste of his glory, and that's what he said, you know, you're going to see a taste of the kingdom. And he's a representative of that kingdom, and, you know, that kingdom signifies glory and majesty and spirit being, and the world of spirit beings. And so that's what he showed them. That's why he was transfigured. And that's what Moses basically wanted. And that's, again, what Jacob here is requesting. Please, you know, show me your glory, in other words, and go through this transfiguration so I can see you in your dazzling beauty and majesty and glory, not just as a man. And I guess after wrestling all day, you know, that is all night, he develops, you know, a certain kind of bond there and intimacy that you get to the point where you can ask that. Well, God was not interested in at this point of doing it. And that's what, in essence, he was telling Moses. And Moses is known in history as the only man who ever saw God yet, you know, face to face on one hand, as he spoke to him, and also as a divine being when he showed him his glory, though not his face. And so this is what we read here. And so Jacob said, I have seen God. You see, it was God that he was wrestling with, and a lot of people, you know, they look at that and they think, well, some people think, yes, it is a divine being, but, you know, they think it's an angel. And other people think, I don't know how they come up with this notion, that this was actually Esau fighting with him. And that, of course, it's total nonsense. But he was wrestling with God himself, in person. And this was a wrestling match that is meant to be not only for Jacob as it is there in reality, but for every single person who is going to walk with God. And if he's to earn the name Israel, it's a name you have to earn. You don't just get it for nothing. You see, God may graft us into Israel, spiritual, those who are already physically Israelites, and he's going to graft others who are not physically Israelite into this commonwealth of Israel. You see, but until we earn it, indeed, in wrestling with God, in overcoming, in enduring until the end, we will not be Israel. You see? So that's the fullness of it. Just like, you know, we are saved when Christ applies his blood for us, and then there is a process of salvation that you go through the process of conversion, through the entirety of your life. End of it, when you are really saved, change from flesh and blood, from corruptible, be it, well, you know, if you are alive or in the grave, into immortality and incorruptible. So you've got three phases there. Well, the same thing with Israel. You may be called Israel. You have to go through this period of time when you struggle, and you become an Israelite through the struggle on an everyday basis, and then ultimately you're becoming a prince with God. And that's what it means also Israel, a prince of God, and also one that wrestles with God. And the word itself, prince or tsar in Hebrew, comes from the fact that a person struggles and overcomes, and therefore he rises to the top, and then by deed he became a prince, not by birth, where he had nothing to do with it. And so this is what we see here. And then we read in verse 32, well, in verse 31 he says, I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. In other words, that didn't kill me. Because that was again the notion of the people of the time. You know, you see God, you're going to die, because no man can see God and be alive. But obviously he didn't die. And the sun rose upon him as he passed over Peniel, and he limped upon his thigh, because that's what God had done. You know, he touched his thigh, and he was limping now. You know, his socket was out. And apparently for the rest of his life he remained that way, as a symbol of that wrestling with God. So he had a constant reminder there for the rest of his life. And so we read later on, therefore the children of Israel, eat not the sinew of the thigh vein, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day. So this is what Moses is writing, because of that event, the children of Israel decided, I don't know what they decided to do that, you know, what's got, you know, that has nothing to do with an animal, but in commemoration of that, you see, that's what they took upon themselves. And so as long as they did that, also, they retained their identity as the children of Jacob. And so this is what we read, and to this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh, even in the sinew of the thigh vein. And then we continue now with chapter 33. Now that God had that wrestling match with Jacob, and Jacob with him, and Jacob overcame, and then the victory now was given to Jacob. In other words, the victory over his brother, in the sense that his brother is not going to overcome him, but he, since he overcame and wrestled with God, obviously God is going to subdue all of his enemies under him. And so we see the end result of that here, the immediate end result of that. And that has also an eternal implication in the sense of history also. That as long as Israel wrestles with God and overcomes and prevails, you see, and doesn't give up, God is going to deliver him from Esau. And Esau is going to be a perpetual enemy, and he will be until the end of time, when God himself is going to come down, and as the king of Israel, and whose name also oftentimes is called Israel, for short, he is going to subdue Esau, and Jacob will prevail, and Jacob will again reign over Esau. And so here we just see, whatever we read here, these are also examples for future centuries to come, and to this very day. And so we read in chapter 33, 9, verse 1, and Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. You know, he's still riding, you know, the 400 men, and obviously this is an act of war, but God was going to do something here at this point. And so Jacob divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel. This is the second division here. The children of Leah on one side, the children of Rachel on the other, and of course their handmaids, and unto the two handmaids. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. So, you know, sort of priority in his sight of who was more important to him, and which one of them he loved the most. And at this point, we're talking about the children of Rachel, that means only Joseph. So it's Rachel and Joseph hindermost. Benjamin was not born yet. And he himself passed over before them, bowed himself to the ground 7 times. You see? Now when you meet someone, you know, the custom is that you bow, you know, just like the Japanese do to this very day. And you just bow, you see? But here, when you bow to the ground, that's something you do before a king. So you see how he humbled himself all the way, you know, with all that he already done before that, you know, sending the first contingents there, you know, with gifts to Esau, every one of them saying to him, your servant Jacob, and they're calling him Lord, you know, he's referring to his brother as Lord, And yet all that apparently did not faze Jacob, that is Esau, too much. Well, here it is, Jacob himself coming before him, sending in all these small groups ahead of him, and he himself and every single one of them had to bow down before Esau. You see, in other words, total subservient. And, you know, it does something to a person when people humble themselves before him like that. You know, he doesn't feel as belligerent as he is. In other words, Jacob does his part. And even when God brings us deliverance, we must do our part. You see, it's not that we do absolutely nothing. And so we do not create even more frictions, more problems. It matters, but, you know, we do whatever we can, and then we ask God to do what we cannot do. And that's what he's doing here. So he bows seven times, which is totally uncommon. You do it only toward a great king. And that's the kind of honor that he gives him. And obviously Esau is impressed with that. And something happens also in between, what God does to his heart. And so we read, he bows down seven times to the ground until he came near to his brother. That's total humbleness, total humiliating of self, total subservience. And Esau, you know, that was hurt very much, being the firstborn, and, you know, Jacob, his brother, takes advantage of him. He's being exalted in his own sight now, you know, with all these actions of Jacob. And so here is the reaction and the ultimate in what God is really doing here, beside all what Jacob was doing. And, you know, this is an example for all of us. When we deal with people, be it small or great, if we humble ourselves before them instead of coming to them with a confrontational mentality, you know, that just creates even more fire, sort of throwing fuel into the fire, then, you know, we're going to have peace with them. We're going to pacify them. We're going to, you know, remove the wind, you know, from their sails, so to speak. And that's how peace occurs. It's because there is no pride, that is, there is no humility, there is no meekness. Instead of that, there is pride and arrogance, and I'm as good as you are, and, you know, and so forth. That's when problems come. That's what the proverb tells us. Before fall comes pride. It's when people are proud, you see, that they finally fall. And people who walk with God cannot afford to be that. You see, God is not going to help a proud person. God resists the proud. And you can ask him all we want for help. If we are proud in our heart, if we're not willing to humble ourselves, even when we are right, you see, before our brother or sister, whatever it may be, if we're not willing to do that and coming to them, there's even the law, you know, that Paul was talking about. You know, law means a teaching. That's all it means. You know, sometimes you forget what law means. But basically, this is what the law is, or the teachings of God. You see, every teaching that comes out of the mouth of God is the law unto us. It's a command. It's not a suggestion. And so he inspired Paul to say that, you know, in the ministry, when some, you know, ministers have to deal with brethren, and obviously with other ministers, but generally speaking, you know, when they have to deal with brethren in terms of a misunderstanding, disagreement, you know, a lack of knowledge and understanding, or somebody, you know, thinks that he knows better than the minister, whatever it may be, he says that you come to them in the spirit of meekness, not in the spirit of arrogance and haughtiness. Well, I'm the minister, and I'm an authority. See what I mean? That's unfortunately was the attitude of many, and that's pride. And because of that pride, you know, they were not able to help that brother stand, but he fell, you see? We caused him to fall because he got angry, you know, and he departed and took off, or he was brokenhearted, you know, broken spirit, whatever it may be, you see. We do not achieve the right results. And that's what Paul is saying. That's what God is inspiring him, you know, in the spirit of meekness, as he's saying to Timothy. You know, you reason with those people. Peradventure, he said, you know, that you might gain your brother. And that's the intent, you see. Jacob here was interested in gaining his brother's favor, not wrath. You see? So this is not a time, as a matter of fact, there should never be a time for arrogance or haughtiness or pride or I'm as good as you are. You see? That's what Christ was saying. Blessed are the peacemakers. You don't make peace when you come with a spirit of confrontation. I am right, you're wrong, you know, that's your problem and not mine. You see, you did wrong and I didn't. You know, you wronged me, so forth. And that's, you know, total lack of wisdom on the part of many. And unfortunately, that's what many are doing. And, you know, that's the reason why we've got all these conflicts among the congregations, you know. The splits, there's too much pride there. And the leaders are the ones who are the most guilty. The higher they are, the more haughty and arrogant they are and proud, unfortunately. And it takes only a very humble person, and there are many among them. You know, you see the example of Moses. What did he do when people came to him complaining and griping and bellyaching and speaking evil of God and of him? You know, we read it again and again and again, several times. He fell down on his face. You see, he didn't say, well, I'm Moses, the servant of God. You know, whom do you think you are? He hasn't done that. Because remember what God said about Moses. He's the meekest man on the face of the earth. And we have to learn that. And that's exactly what Jacob is doing here. We're talking about a very deeply converted man. He's not just, you know, he's putting on a show. He really humbled himself because he realized, you see, through all these 20 years of persecution by another deceitful man, you know, even more deceitful than he is, how wrong it was of him to wrong his brother. You see, especially due to the fact that God already gave it to him and there was no reason for him to be haughty and arrogant. Now, that was a lesson that even Joseph himself later on, his son, had to learn. You see, he was given the preeminence and the birthright, and yet he became haughty and arrogant and started exalting himself above his brothers, even his own parents. And he told them the dreams in a haughty attitude, and so God, you know, humbled him. And he caused him to go through all these calamities in order to test him and try him. And then when he learned humility and recognized, you know, how to walk with God and to walk with his fellow man, that's when God exalted him. That's in essence what God is telling us. You humble yourself before the mighty God and he will exalt you. And when we come before a brother who wronged us or whom we did wrong, or maybe it was a mistake, nobody really meant it, we should always come with a spirit of humility and meekness. And then peace will occur. And that's the reason why there is no peace on this earth. There are too many proud people out there trying to negotiate, you know, the hard way. Trying to get as much as they can from the other person. Well, that's not peacemaker. Those are warmongers. And so, this is what we see, the end result of a person doing it God's way, humbling himself before his brother. And so in verse 4, we read, the outcome of that, which God is in essence behind it, because of Jacob's attitude of humility. And so we see in verse 4, and Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. You see what a total, you know, opposite reaction to the beginning when Esau heard that his brother Jacob is coming back, and he said, oh, this is my chance, and he takes his 400 men, he's full of fury, he's angry, he's dashing toward his brother. He's going to destroy him and all that he has. You see? War was in his mind. Anger. Strife. You see? But look how God turned the whole thing around. That's what the proverb already tells us, that it also tells us. That when a man's ways are pleasing in the sight of God, he makes even his enemies to become his friend. So, sometimes we have to ask ourselves the question, why is it that we have problems with some people? And they constantly persecute us, and we cry to God, and nothing happens. You see, and that could be within the family, that could be within the marriage, that could be, you know, in any situation or at work. Maybe our ways are not pleasing in the sight of God. That doesn't mean that this is always that way, you know. After all, Christ himself was being persecuted, and yet the general attitude that we find toward him is, as we read in the beginning, that he grew in grace with God and men. You see, yes, there were always, you know, a few hot-headed, but generally speaking, there was an awful lot of grace, and even many of his enemies had high respect and regard for him. You see? And so this is what happens when we humble ourselves before God. And so this is what happens. Magnificent, you know, scenario you see here. Mortal enemies, so to speak, are becoming best friends. And so he ran toward him. That's excitement, not to destroy or to kill, you see. And he runs toward him to meet him, you know, not to destroy him. And he embraces him, you see, which is the opposite of the feelings he had before. and he falls on his neck and he kisses him, and they both weep. You see? Only God can produce that. And ultimately speaking, when all is said and done, you see, when Jacob is brought to repentance of all the evil himself that he had done to his brother Jacob, that is Esau, and as you know, we covered before that, who is Esau in terms of Jacob, and Jacob is not handling Esau properly. He's not treating him with respect. You know, this is one of the major qualities that Esau thrives on. He loves respect. And Jacob, unfortunately, does not show Esau, his elder brother, obviously. Jacob doesn't know who Esau is, but Jacob is not like his father, Jacob. He doesn't follow that example. And therefore, God is not with him in this sense, and therefore, he's going to allow Esau to afflict him one more time before God finally purifies, you know, Jacob of all of his filthiness and all the evil that he had done to Esau, you know, be it in the Americas, be it in any other place, you know, where the two of them are together. In Israel, it's the same. You don't see much respect as it should be there, and honor in the land of Israel between Judah and the Palestinians, you know, many of whom are Edomites. And that creates a lot of problems. In other words, they do not know the way of peace. Jacob today does not know the way of peace, and so he's going to have to pay the penalty for it. And then finally, when he learns the way of peace, God is going to reconcile these two brothers again. That is, the remnant of both of them. There are going to be very few left of Esau. But after all, we still have the second resurrection coming. And so we're going to see a repetition of this scenario here in the future. And verse 5 we read, and he lifted up his eyes, that is Esau, and he saw the women and the children, and said, "Who are these with you?" And he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." You see, it continues in that. And he really means it. It's not a put-on on the part of Jacob. He deeply recognizes and fully recognizes and fully has repented of the deceitfulness that he inflicted on his brother. And he caused him to hate him. You see, when he really didn't have to do any of that. All he had to do is, and he said, well, you know, it's all up to God, and let him do whatever he wishes. He did not have to be deceitful ever, neither with the selling of the birthright, you know, for the morsel of bread. In essence, he was taking advantage of his brother, and that was wrong in his time of weakness. Nor should he have listened to his mother, Rebekah, and her deceitfulness in this matter about the birthright. Both of them should have believed in God. And so he, in essence, brought it upon himself. And Esau, in that sense, was right for what he did to him. You see? Not in terms of to whom does it belong, the birthright. That was already decided. In this case, Esau was wrong. And so he continues with this attitude of total humility and meekness, spirit of peace. And then verse 6 we read, then the handmaids came near, and they and their children, and they bowed down. You see, total respect and honor to the elder brother, as it should be. And Leah also and her children came near and bowed down, and after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed down. You see? And when all is said and done, and the reconciliation occurs between Jacob and Esau, you see, Joseph and all the others are going to show respect to the elder, the children of the elder brother, Esau. You know, present day you find them in among the Spanish people. And obviously not all Spanish people are of Esau, because many of them are the ones that Esau intermarried with. The Indians in this country, or any other people in other countries, wherever he is. And in the Middle East, you know, he intermarried with Canaanites and Philistines and Ammonites and Moabites and others. But, you know, when all is said and done, there's going to be mutual respect and honor and mutual submission. You know, the ultimate, as Paul would say, you know, you all submit to each other in the fear of the Lord. And it's going to happen. So, you know, what we see here is just an example, you might say, of what is ultimately going to happen in the future. So, this lesson here Jacob already learned and is displaying then, and his children are going to do it in the future. And hopefully, those of us who understand these matters and have the Spirit of God and are peacemakers on both sides of the fence, be it Jacob or Esau, are going to show respect and honor toward one another, not animosity or hatred or malice or darkness or, pointing the fingers and blaming each other. Oh, we shouldn't do that. And so this is a wonderful example to follow here. And then we read in verse 8, and he said, What do you mean by all this camp which I met? In other words, all the things that he sent before me, because he was already told it's all for you. It's not really that he didn't know, but he's just asking him anyway. And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. You see, after all, he wronged him. And when you wrong someone, you have to find favor, you have to regain. You see, what you have destroyed, and to regain the favor, well, you have to bring an offering. And we do the same thing with God. When we are out of favor with him, and favor means grace, that's what the word means, grace. That's how you grow in grace in the sight of God. How do you grow in grace in the sight of God? Some people hear that and don't know what it means. Don't know what to do with it. You see? Now, when you are already in the grace of God, you don't need to find grace in the sight of God, you see? But when you are falling out of favor, out of grace, because we are sinning, we're doing wrong, we're doing things which are not pleasing in the sight of God, then we turn around, we repent, we come before God, and we bring an offering. And that was the nature of all the offerings that God commanded Israel to bring before him. You see? They have fallen out of grace. Oftentimes, and to turn back to God, they have to turn around, repent, bring an offering before him, and find favor in his sight. In other words, find grace. And that's how we grow in grace. You see? And also, as we do the things which are pleasing in his sight, and he wants to be honored as king, you see, and we show proper honor when we bring a sacrifice before him, be it a sacrifice of praise, or doing good in his sight, doing things which are pleasing in his sight, and all those things we do to find favor in his sight, and that's how we grow in grace. So it's a literal thing that we do. It's not an ethereal thing. Some people don't know what it means to grow in grace in the sight of God. And to find favor in his sight. And so he said, I've done all that to find favor in the sight of my Lord. And it's not a bribe. You see, we don't bribe God. See, it's done wrong. You see? Or when we come before a king, it would be wrong if we don't bring an offering. You see? So it's not a question of bribing. It's a question of finding favor in the sight of God and man. And we have to be honorable, toward one another that way. And obviously, when people become covetous, then the favor becomes a bribe. And that shouldn't be that way. A bribe is done with the wrong attitude, but to find favor, that's something else. And some people go from one extreme to the other. And in many countries, they still understand that. And so those who do understand that and do it properly, that's, when they give a gift, that's to find favor. And those who are doing it with the wrong attitude, that's to bribe a person. You see? So this is the difference between the two. And, we've forgotten that and don't know the difference. That's the office of the priest, to make teach people the difference between the holy and the profane. When giving a gift is finding favor, and when giving a gift is a bribe. You see, when is it profane and when is it holy? And so this is what he's saying here. What he'd done was right, was not wrong. So he said, I've done it to find favor in your sight, the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough. You see, because God blessed him, just like the blessing that Esau gave him, that is Isaac, his father, gave him. It was a real blessing, not a curse, as some say that, misunderstanding the scriptures. He said, I have enough, I have plenty. And he says, my brother, he said, I have enough, my brother. See, he's not calling him my servant, even though Jacob addressed himself as such. He says, my brother. So that's why he's now on his level. Let that which you have be yours. I've got mine, you've got yours. You don't need to give me of yours. It's enough that we're reconciled and you are now my brother. By the mere fact that you humbled yourself, you recognize what you've done wrong. You submitted yourself to me. I am the elder brother. You gave me respect and honor. That's enough. In essence, what he's saying. He's not covetous. It's not what he was after. He was not after these things, that belonged to Jacob. He was after his submission. Showing respect and honor to the elder brother instead of deceiving him every which way. And Jacob said, "Nay, I pray you, if now I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present at my hand, for as much as I have seen your face, as one sees the face of God." And he was pleased with me. In other words, he's saying, you know, "I'm so excited to see you, it's as if I've seen God himself." And of course, you know, Esau, you know, feels pretty good about it. You know, it's again, he shows him respect and honor and love and affection, and all those things are pleasing. You see, these are all the elements of making peace. And all that should be done not with a false attitude, you know, but in a genuine manner. And Esau recognized that in Jacob. Esau, a totally different man than the who deceived him 20 years earlier. And so he says to him, "Take, I pray you, my gift that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." So I still have plenty. And he urged him, and he took it. And he said, "Let us take our journey, and let us go, and I will go before you." Now also, something else works here in the Middle East, and obviously in many other countries where they have these customs. When you give a gift to someone, and he receives it from you, he cannot turn around and hurt you after that. You see, that's against the protocol of the society. And a man is going to lose his honor totally in the sight of his fellow man if he takes a gift from someone and then turns around and hurts him. Because when you take a gift, you in essence make a covenant with a person, covenant of friendship. And so in societies where honor is extremely important, even more than life, you lose your honor, you lose your life, might as well, you know, commit a suicide in those places. You know, that was also an element here that Jacob was using, not, you know, deceitfully, but in the right way. And Esau also knew that. And so he urged him, and he took it. And he said in verse 12, "Let us take our journey," that is Esau saying that, "and let us go, and I will go before you." In other words, I'm going to lead you back to where you're going. Well, Jacob was not interested at this time to have all this army with him, and he has to run forward. He just wanted to settle this matter here and get it over with and go his own way. And so he says to Jacob, "My Lord knows that the children are tender and that the flocks and herds giving suck are a care to me." In other words, you know, it's not easy for them to run. You know, you are on horses. Obviously, you're going to go faster. So I'm going to go, you know, going to be good with us. And if they overdrive them one day, all the flocks will die. So we can't do that. So I said, "Let my Lord, I pray you, pass over before his servant, and I will journey on gently, according to the face of the cattle that are before me, and according to according to the pace of the cattle." In other words, we're going to go slowly, you go faster. You go at your pace, I go at my pace, and the pace of the children, until I come unto my Lord, unto Seir. So in essence, this is not really what Jacob meant to do, to go all the way to Seir, but he still needed to say that, and obviously that was not totally true. So you might say there's a little bit of deceitfulness here to a degree, but then on the other hand, sometimes, you know, you still have to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove, and he wasn't sure, you know, what was Esau ultimately is up to. And so he has to say, "Well, I'll be coming to Seir too." Instead of saying, "Well, you know, just get out of my sight." And so, again, sometimes, you know, you have to say certain things to appease the opponent. And then later on, you know, you just say, "Well, you know, I was going on my way there, and then I've decided to, you know, go somewhere else," whatever. Whichever is the case, you know, that's what he's saying here. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth. Well, instead of going to Seir, he went to Succoth, which apparently not too far from there anyway. But Seir was the land of Esau, and he was not interested in dwelling in Seir anyway, so there was no reason for him to go there. But, you know, he can be going toward that land, but end up somewhere else. And then, later on, you know, the relationship is still good. He can always come and visit his brother. And which apparently, once they have reconciled themselves, obviously they've done that, because we read later on, when their father Isaac died, both of them were there. And it was not in a state of war, but in a state of peace. So what happened behind the scenes, you know, the Bible did not decide to record. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him a house and made booths for his cattle, and that's why the name of the place is called Succoth. Therefore, the name of the place is called Sukkot. We read here, and Jacob came in peace. See, everything went peacefully all the way to the city of Shechem. And that's where his father was earlier, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and encamped before the city. Now, his father was actually toward Beersheba, further down, and Shechem was higher. And he came to that place, and that was a place of Canaanites, and we're going to read about the story later on that happened in the next chapter. In that very city, it was a Canaanite city. And why didn't he go directly to where his father was, we don't know. The account doesn't tell us details here. But obviously, as he goes to his, back to the old country, obviously he went to see his father. It just, the Bible decides to record only the places where he and his whole family finally located themselves, not necessarily the visit with his father in between. God, records the things that are important for him to record. As for the other details, he doesn't choose to. That is left to history. And the people that were alive at the time and knew those things, and they pass it on to, from generation to generation. That, in essence, remains an aspect of the oral law and not the written law. And so, in verse 19 we read, and he bought a parcel of ground where he had spread his tent. In other words, he was not going to live there at the expense of the Canaanites there. He literally bought a piece of land, and that became his. And even though the whole land was already his, by divine law, you see, but nevertheless, just like Christ would say, the children are not supposed to pay tax, but, in order not to offend them, let's pay tax to them. And so this is the same principle here. And so we read in verse 19, and he bought the parcel of ground where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor. Hamor, it's interesting, in Hebrew means donkey. I don't know, why would a man give his name, his son that name? Hamor. And he lived in Shechem. Shechem means basically shoulder. In other words, the city was built on the shoulder of the hill, and so they called it shoulder. And that's what Shechem means. And so the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, and I guess the father, his name was Hamor, for 100 pieces of money. Now, that's a lot of money. Basically, about 30 pieces, you bought a good piece of land, and 100 pieces of money, you're talking about good-sized land, and when you consider all the blessings that God gave Jacob, if he was able to give his brother as a gift, hundreds of animals, so he must have had an awful lot, thousands of them, and many servants. Obviously, he needed a large piece of land. In other words, Jacob was not a small party, but a big one. And all that came not from the flocks and the herds and all the blessings, that God gave Isaac, but that's something that he gave him, and he earned it by work himself. And so you don't see here the situation where he had with Laban, where as long as he was alive, Laban owned everything. Now as he comes to visit his father doesn't own anything here, and it's all his, so they're not even living together. And they live in two separate places, and obviously not far from each other. But for some reason, when Isaac is on his own, they don't mention Abraham anymore, even though he's around. The story continues with Isaac, and so when Jacob is grown up here, and even Esau, Isaac is not mentioned, and though he's still around. And there's a separation there that apparently God wants it that way. And so this is where he dwells here, and he erected there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. In other words, God, or the deity, or the deities of Israel. In other words, God is, that's his name, El, and Elohe Israel means the God of Israel. So this El here, everybody would know as they pass by, and they write on it. Actually, in those days, that's what they did. They would know that this is an altar to the God of Israel. And he was Israel. He's the first Israel here. Nobody was in Israel before that. Isaac was not. Abraham was not. They were not Israelites. And some people find it strange to even think that way. But Israel is the first Israel, just like Judah was the first Jew. And this is the name that he gave it. And like Isaac and like Abraham, they offered sacrifices in those days. Obviously, the law was not yet given to Israel, where God would choose the place where they would sacrifice. And there was a ministry, you see, and he told them you cannot do it just anywhere. Well, here, the fathers, wherever they went, that's where they erected an altar, and this is where they sacrificed to God. And that's exactly what he's doing here. And he's renewing his relationship, in essence, with God. And apparently, back in the old country, he may not have done that. He probably did not have an altar there. But when it comes to back to the land, then he does that because God is a God of Israel, the God of the land of Israel, and that's his heritage. And God made it very plain, several places throughout history, that he chose Jerusalem. That's later on, and then he chose the land to be his land, and so you see the special relationship there of God with the land and the people. Anyway, we're going to stop here before we continue with the next chapter, and this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people until next time.